If we haven't met, my name's Brian Paul. I'm a partner at Ice Miller. On February 1st of this year, Indiana became the 23rd state in the nation with the right to work law. As stated by Governor Daniels in a press release issued in support of the legislation, Right to Work says only that no worker can be forced to pay union dues in order to keep a job. Here to make the case for Right to Work laws is Stan Greer. Mr. Greer is on the staff of the National Right to Work Committee, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, single-purpose citizens organization that combats compulsory unionism and promotes public support for right to work legislation. Please welcome Mr. Greer.
Good to be with you today. I don't know exactly how long I'm going to talk for. I'm open to questions. I can keep talking longer if there aren't a lot of questions. There are a lot of questions. I'm glad to just to take a lot of questions. But I will at least give some background on right to work laws. How many of you are familiar with the, there was a right to work law in Indiana before, passed in 1957? I assume some of you heard of that. No, it is. If you haven't heard of the law of your only passing knowledge, it is an interesting, just as an aside, to bring up, because it is, you could call it a case, definitely a case of judicial activism, or at least at the National Right to Work Committee and the other right to work organizations, we definitely would call it that, because the 1957 law in Indiana actually said that you can't be required to join or support a union in order to get or keep a job. And the federal law, background was different in 1957 than it is today. Because back in the 1950s, there was no distinction between being forced to join a union or being forced just to be a dues payer or an agency fee payer under federal law. You could be forced, as far as anybody knew, because the U.S. Supreme Court had not spoken, you could be forced to join a union as a condition of employment. And those of you who are involved in labor law know that's what, even today, the Taft-Hartley Act, or the National Labor Relations Act, says, is that you have to join a union within 30 days, or I'm not a lawyer, whatever it is, 60 days after you get the job, or you can be fired. It doesn't say anything about paying a reduced fee, which doesn't include things other than collective bargaining and the cost. Back in the 50s, there was no distinction. But as soon as the law was passed in Indiana, some union lawyers got together and they thought up what they thought was a pretty good idea, and it worked pretty well, that, all right, we can't force people to join the union anymore, but we'll just say, well, you don't have to join the union, but have to pay this agency fee to the union, which is as high as union dues. And then we'll be happy with you, and we won't get you fired. And there's nothing the right to work law can do about this. And even though the law said that you can't be forced to join or support the union, courts in Indiana, starting in about a few months after the law was passed, and then ending in the Mead Electric decision of 1959, the Supreme Court of Indiana ruled that the forced agency fee was permissible under the Indiana right to work law. So you could not be forced to join the union, but you could be forced to pay this fee. And it's the only time that an effort like that has succeeded in any state. There are some right-to-work laws, when they first passed, they just said you can't be forced to join the union, and some of them, and not anything about not being forced to pay dues or fees. When you pass a right-to-work law nowadays, you include all that because you know all the subsequent history and that you need to be crystal clear to avoid that stuff. But a lot of the early right-to-work laws that haven't been amended still say join the union, but they've been interpreted by the courts in those states to mean you can't be forced to join or pay dues or fees or anything to the union as a condition of employment. Didn't work that way in Indiana. And then, the law was still somewhat meaningful after that, somewhat meaningful, because when you're forced to join a union, you're forced not just to financially support a union, you're forced to submit to union discipline in a variety of areas, so you're like basically under the governance of the union to a large extent. And where that's especially significant is in strikes. Now, we subsequently had, decades later, we had a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that says that, if you don't want to participate in a strike, you're a union member, you can resign, and you don't have to participate in the strike. You don't have to go on strike, and you can't be fined for not going on strike as long as you've resigned from the union before you, you know, cease participating in the strike. But back in those days, there was no such decision. So if you had joined the union and the union ordered you out on strike and you went out on strike, you could be fined as much as your pay, full pay, for as long as you worked. So there was still reasons to have the laws, the law in the books. And in fact, despite the history that some of you may have heard in the newspapers lately, actually in the 1960 elections, in the 1962 elections, Big Labor did very bad in the state legislative election, badly in the state legislative elections in Indiana. So there was very little support for repeal of the law, despite the fact that it was in a greatly reduced form. But then in 1963, in the General Motors decision and one other related decision, I think it's called Schimmerhorn, the U.S. Supreme Court said that even in a non-right-to-work state, you can't be forced to join the union. You can only be forced to pay, they call them dues sometimes, but they're what they call financial core dues or agency fees as a condition of employment. So once the Supreme Court said that with regard to all the non-right-to-work states, Indiana was effectively no different from the non-right-to-work states. So when the right-to-work law was finally repealed in 1965, it had no real legal significance at all. And that's And you could argue that it was never really in effect in any kind of full way, because although the state Supreme Court didn't uphold the forced agency fee until 1959, unions were negotiating those right off the bat, and the contracts were still in effect, and the previous contracts. So it was never really enforced in any kind of complete way, and that's an important thing to remember about the previous Indiana right-to-work law when you know, you hear the rhetoric, well, that was such a disaster that it got repealed and Republicans took a bath in 1958. What they don't mention is that Republicans in every state in the country took a bath in 1958, including states where the Republican leadership, thwarted efforts to even have a committee vote on right to work, like in Connecticut. The Republicans did even worse there than they did in Indiana. So it's hard to say that that was a result of the Indiana right to work law passage. But anyway, that was a little bit of a side issue, but it does have Indiana significance. But the basic problem that, you know, is addressed and only partially addressed by state right to work laws is federal labor law, because federal labor law with regard to workers assumes that they're better off if they're coercively collectivized. So that if you have the majority of employees at a business or what is otherwise defined as a bargaining unit wants to have a union, then all of the workers at the business or whatever else is defined as a bargaining unit have to accept the union as their exclusive bargaining agent in matters concerning their pay, benefits, and work rules. And this is justified often on the grounds of majority rule, but you know, if you look into the details, it is clearly not majority rule, because federal labor law also bans company-supported unions. So even if a majority of the employees at the company want to have a union, but a union that's sponsored and in alliance with the company, they can't do that. So majority rule is not in effect when it comes to company-sponsored unions. It also isn't in effect with what's called, derogatorily and maybe justly so, yellow dog contracts. So you can't have a contract that says, if I'm going to accept employment at this place, I will not vote for a union, I won't try to organize this place, I'm not going to be a member of the union, even if a majority of the employees, you know, in a secret ballot election, vote to have a contract like that. They can't vote to have a contract like that. It's illegal, and it's been illegal since before the National Labor Relations Act. So we don't have majority rule. And I would point out another way that we don't have majority rule. We don't have majority rule in the sense that if you have a majority of employees who don't want a union, then they can't vote to prevent those employees who do want to have a union from joining the union. And they also can't vote to prevent employees who do want to have a union and have joined a union from financially supporting that union. So the private organizations that the individual employee supports or doesn't support are not dictated by the views of the majority when the individual employee or the minority of employees want to support a union. But the private decisions about which private organization you'll support are dictated by the majority if you don't want to join a union. So in other words, it's not equal treatment under the law. The freedom of the individual employee depends under federal labor law and under states that don't interfere with it on whether the employee wants a union or he doesn't want a union. I got a little bit ahead of myself. I mean, I think you're familiar with this, but federal labor law, in addition to making unions monopoly exclusive bargaining agents, what we call the National Right to Work Committee monopoly bargaining agents, it also authorizes such unions with exclusive bargaining power to negotiate contracts with employers where all the employees have to, if they refuse to, they either have to join the union or they have to pay agency fees to the union. Sometimes they're just called union dues. But when they're forced to pay these dues as a non-member or agency fees as a non-member, legally, they're not supposed to be anything more than what the cost of collective bargaining is. I'm going to get into that in a little more detail, too. In practice, it really doesn't work that way in most cases, but that is the theory. So anyway, majority of employees can dictate that a minority of employees have to support a financial organization that they don't want to support, but only if the majority are pro-union. You know, if the majority are against the union, then they can't dictate the decisions of the minority. And it's unequal treatment, and in defending it, it used to be that unions were very frank about the fact that what they wanted was unequal treatment under the law for workers who favor a union and workers who don't favor a union. So I'm going to quote a little bit from the Lincoln decision of, I think the decision was finally laid down in 1949, but it was heard in 1948. And this is the case that argued against the constitutionality of right-to-work laws. I don't remember which unions brought it. I assume that both, at the time, the AFL and the CIO were two separate, you know, conglomerates of unions. I assume that attorneys for both the AFL and the CIO were involved in this case. But, and I haven't read the whole brief that they wrote in this case, but it happens that in the unanimous opinion of the court saying that right-to-work laws are constitutional, Justice Hugo Black quoted from the brief. He was so astonished by what it said. And that's what I'm going to quote here. It says, "The right to work as a non-unionist is in no way equivalent to or parallel of the right to work as a union member. There exists no constitutional right to work as a non-unionist on the one hand, while the right to maintain employment free from discrimination because of union membership is constitutionally protected." So normally when we talk about rights, they go both ways, right? So freedom of religion means that you're free to practice your religion, you're also free not to practice a religion, you know, or freedom of speech means you're free to donate to, at least it does under the current Supreme Court, I hope, donate to a political candidate, but it also means you're free not to donate to that political candidate or any other political candidate. But the unions here were saying, here's a constitutional right that's a one-sided right. And incidentally, they're not being as explicit about it, but there was an article in the New York Times the other day, I haven't read it, but it's about a civil right to join a union, and I know the authors, and I can promise you that they will contend that there is a constitutional right to join a union, but there's no constitutional right not to join a union. Maybe there's one not to join a union, but not to withhold financial support from a union. So you can refuse to join, but you can't refuse to withhold financial support. Incidentally, before the General Motors decision, you know, unions were very much against that distinction. So in the General Motors case, the unions argued strenuously before the Supreme Court that it was not good enough for employees to be required simply to pay agency fees to the union if they refused to join the union, that you really needed to have true solidarity, and for the unions to really be effective, they had to be forced to join the union as well and be subject to union discipline. Otherwise, it would just be chaos. So, and that's the way it's really been again and again over history. So in the history since the National Labor Relations Act. So in the 1980s, when the famous Beck case was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, the unions argued that it would not be fair, and it would greatly weaken unions, and it would upset the balance between labor and management if employees who didn't join a union were given a clear-cut right under the court's interpretation of the National Labor Relations Act not to get their money back if they didn't agree with the non-collective bargaining activities of the union, but to have that money not collected in the first place, because that's what really the Beck decision, that's how it was different from previous decisions along the same lines. It said that you have a right not to have the money collected in the first place and not to get a rebate. And it also gave more specific information about what it is that was legally chargeable and not legally chargeable from an objecting non-member. And the unions argued against that, but now, after the Supreme Court ruled against them in 1988, they say, what are you complaining about? I mean, you know, workers who don't want to join a union have more rights than practically anybody in society, because they have a right not to join the union, and they have a right to pay only the costs of collective bargaining. They don't have to pay for any of the politics, so they're so protected. But, A, I don't think they're protected, because I don't think that, and I don't think they would think you're protected if, you know, as a pro-union worker, they say, well, the majority of the workers don't want a union, so you can join the union, but you can't pay dues to the union. But tell you what, you can pay them, you know, their political fund, but you can't pay for any collective bargaining. I guess that would be the exact analogy. They would not think that that was, they would not think that's freedom of association, but they think it's freedom of association enough for a worker who doesn't want to join a union. And in practice, of course, it really doesn't work even as well as that for the worker who doesn't want to join a union in a non-right-to-work state. Because the Supreme Court has also said, and I'll bring this up because none of them are here, but this is a case brought by my partners, my friends at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. And it's really good because for us at the committee, because it helps us show how bad federal law is. You know, it wasn't really their intent to get that result. But what the Supreme Court ruled in the Marquez case in 1998 is that even though you have a right not to join a union and you have a right to not pay for anything except for collective bargaining, it's fine if a union contract says that you have to join the union within 30 days or you're fired. And it's fine also for a union official to point to that contract where you're being hired and say, look at this, you know, see, you have to join within 30 days or you're fired. And that's fine. Now, the union does, in some fashion, have to notify you at some time that, in fact, you don't have to join the union. So they have to, if they choose to do that, they have to kind of send a double message. But they can put that message in the union newsletter, you know, once a year, where those workers who don't want to join the union are probably not too likely to see it. So that's clear under federal law. Even though you can't be forced to join the union, the contract can tell you you are forced to join the union, and the union can tell you that. You have to know that you can't be forced to join the union. And so you say to the union official, no, you're lying to me. I can't be forced to join a union. I can only be forced to pay fees that cover collective bargaining and not anything else. So you tell me what it is. What's the collective bargain? And I'll pay that because I have to, not because I want to. And the union can respond, well, it's, you know, we don't really spend anything on anything except for collective bargaining. So it's 99.5%. It's 99.5%. So fine, if you want 99.5%, that's fine. But then, you know, you won't get to vote on your contract, and you won't have any say at all in the terms of your job. You know, because we negotiate the contract. You don't have any say in that. But fine, you get your 0.5% reduction. And assuming that's a lie, which it probably is, I mean, there might be some unions that are like that, you know, the only way that the worker gets justice is by taking the union to court. And even if he takes the union to court, and the Right to Work Foundation does provide free legal aid in that case, so it may not be at much direct cost to himself, probably some, because there are some things the foundation probably just doesn't cover. But it's not at much cost himself, but a great grief in most cases, and usually a substantial amount of time. But the union will have to then, you know, give you your money back. Or, you know, if the money was, you know, in some kind of a fund, then they'll have to release it from that fund. But they don't have to, they have no penalty or anything like that, other than the money that was withheld from you, they have to give it to you. The money that was withheld from you illegally, that is, they have to give it to you once it's over. So there's really no great cost to the union. I guess they may sometimes end up, you know, having more legal fees than they want to as a result of these cases. Although often, if the worker actually has the nerve to sue, it can end pretty rapidly, you know, because they don't have a very good case and they won't actually go to court. But you know, most workers don't know that that's the thing. So a right that is only, you know, workable if you are willing to at least threaten to go to court is not, for most employees, a very significant right. And that's why, you know, it's necessary to point out that it's perfectly legal for unions to spend agency fees, forced agency fees from non-members on politics unless the non-member objects. So just refusing to join the union does not count as an objection under federal labor law. You have to object again on top of that, because the courts kind of assume, well, even if you don't want to join the union, you may really want to contribute to their political activities and their other non-collective bargaining activities. You know, so you really have to affirm that separately to exercise your right not to pay for that stuff. What time have we got? I don't really know. So anyway, right-to-work laws fix a lot of that because they make financial support for the union fully voluntary. They don't do anything about the exclusive union bargaining. And so the union remains the exclusive bargaining agent of all the employees. And I should say that this is federal labor law when it comes to the vast majority of private sector employees, farm employees, and a couple other categories being an exception. But and of course, managerial employees are not covered by, you know, they're not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. So you can't be forced to have a union as your bargaining agent or anything like that if you're management or supervisor or anything like that. In government, it's often different. But the reason it's different in government is that's covered by state laws, and states may have very different policies from the federal government. But that's private sector employees in the vast majority of the country are covered by federal law, and the exclusive bargaining portion of the National Labor Relations Act has no exception, like Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Act, which says that states can supersede or they can circumvent federal law and have, you know, no forced dues payment or forced fee payment. So exclusive bargaining is the law of the land in all 50 states. And unions will complain about this. They'll say that, you know, this is the reason why right-to-work laws are so bad, because we're forced to represent all the employees, even those who don't want to join, and this is a great burden on us. But the fact is that unions prefer exclusive bargaining over members-only bargaining, although, as I was discussing before the meeting, members-only bargaining is permissible under federal law. Maybe I can get to that in the questions afterwards. It is permissible, but it's rarely practiced. And the reason is because exclusive union bargaining really doesn't benefit all employees. It benefits some employees, I'm sure, and maybe, I'm not even, as a right-to-work staffer, I might even be willing to concede it benefits most employees economically, or at least it benefits them economically in some ways. But it clearly doesn't benefit all employees, and I, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. There are many scholars of labor law who are opposed to right-to-work laws and supportive of federal labor policy generally, who say the same thing. One example is somebody that you may know if you follow labor law a lot. It's Richard Freeman. I forget. I think he's an economist, actually, but he's one of the most prominent commentators on, and he's at Harvard, he's one of the most prominent academic allies of organized labor, you know, and he has been for decades. He wrote a famous book in the mid-1980s called What Do Unions Do, which is basically an apology for the impact of unions. But he acknowledges that, you know, one of the things that unions do is compression of wages, which is good if you're, you know, one of the employees in a bargaining unit who are doing a similar kind of job who is one of the less good employees, or one of the less productive employees, because then you get paid more as a result of that. But the other side of the coin, as Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute, which is a think tank funded by the unions, always supports unions, the other side of the coin is that higher pay for the less productive workers is paid for in part, largely by reducing pay of the most productive workers. So And that's not the only way, he would say, but he acknowledges that that's one of the ways. And so there are, by the witness of the longtime research associate of the Economic Policy Institute, which probably doesn't mean anything to you, but they're my nemeses, so I know who they are. They're the AFL-CIO funded think tank. He says that the most productive workers get paid less as a result of a union contract. And just to clarify that, to make sure that's what he's saying, he goes on to say that if, you know, a large share of the workforce isn't unionized, that's going to be bad. It's going to break down the system because unionization is good, because the more productive workers will be lured away to the non-union businesses that will pay them more. But if, you know, the whole sector is organized, or at least a big chunk of it is, then there'll be fewer opportunities for them to do that. It won't break down, so the less productive workers will benefit, and everybody will be happy. And you know, I mean, to be fair, what Rothstein goes on to say is that raises everybody's productivity because everybody feels solidarity. But the research actually shows, is that you know, and I'm citing a paper from a few years ago by Barry Hirsch at Trinity University, who's I wouldn't say he's an apologist for the unions, but he's written me a nasty letter two of the year, so he's not exactly an opponent either. Barry Hirsch, and he's one of the main scholars, says that unions, on average, have no impact on the productivity of business, which is better than what a lot of people would say. They would say it has a negative, and certainly in some cases they do have a negative impact on the productivity of the business. He would argue in other cases they have a positive impact, but on average he would say zero impact. Of course, when you put that together with the fact that they do have an impact on raising the average pay, that means that the business is going to be less profitable and less competitive, and that's why unionized businesses are clearly, as even supporters of the labor law system we have acknowledge, are less apt to grow and hire new employees, and that's putting it in a positive way. You know, there's debate about whether or not they're more apt to go bankrupt. That's what some opponents of unions would say, and I'm not even going to argue that. I'll argue what's universally conceded, that the unionized businesses are less apt to grow and to hire additional employees, which even people like Freeman would say, yeah, that's right. And, of course, one effect of that is another detrimental impact on employees of a wide array of employees at a unionized business. That means there are fewer opportunities for you to get promoted within the business, which is a common way of advancing in a career, is not to switch to another business, but to get promoted within your own business. It's much harder to do that if your business isn't growing and expanding the number of employees. So on balance, you know, there are some workers who are hurt by unions. There are some workers that are harmed by unions. I'm not arguing for the abolition of unions. We will say that the current labor law system, which encourages union monopolies, is generally detrimental. It doesn't mean that what's really an unnecessary and unfair power can never be used for good. I'm sure that monopoly power sometimes is used for good, but in general, that kind of power is more often abused than it's used for positive purposes. So the National Right to Work Committee favors not just enactment of more right to work laws, but replacement of the current system with a members-only bargaining system. And, you know, in the past, it was easier for unions to just say that's anti-union, but nowadays, as some of you may know, or maybe nobody knows, the unions are actually pushing members-only bargaining too, of course, in a totally different way than what I'm pushing it, or what the National Right to Work Committee is pushing. The National Right to Work is in favor of it to replace the current system of exclusive union bargaining. For more as a way to expand the foot in the door for exclusive union bargaining. So the Supreme Court, back in 1938 in the Consolidated Edison decision, said that even though we already have the National Labor Relations Act, if there's no exclusive bargaining union agent, exclusive union bargaining agent recognized, then an employer is free to bargain with the union that represents maybe even a majority of employees, as was the case in this particular instance, or a minority of employees on a members-only basis. So it was a members-only union at Consolidated Edison, even though it was a majority union. Most often, members-only unionism isn't talked about in regard to minority unions nowadays, though. You know, unions that don't represent them. So they can't get exclusive bargaining power because you need to have a majority. I mean, you can fudge as we probably know, to show through card checks or other devices to create a majority. But if you can't get an, even the appearance of a majority, you can't have an exclusive bargaining power. But what Consolidated Edison didn't really make clear is whether employers have to bargain with such unions. So the law has been interpreted since then to be basically that it's a voluntary bargaining. And unions will say that's no good. Although the truth is that if they sought members-only bargaining in cases where they clearly had the majority, and if they said, well, if you don't recognize it on a members-only basis, we'll seek we'll be the exclusive bargaining agent, we'll go for an NLRB election, we'll get the exclusive, then I don't know why employers wouldn't agree to that, because I think most employers would see it as a lesser evil, assuming they don't want to be unionized. But the unions say that's no good, so we want to make members-only bargaining mandatory, where even if just a couple of your workers want a union, then you have to bargain with that union on a members-only basis, and they have a case before the National Labor Relations Board now that that contends that. I mean, they haven't made it anywhere yet, and it's not clear they will, even with the current administration being sympathetic. But for them, it wouldn't be, you know, you would retain the exclusive bargaining. So if a members-only union got in place and it got to a majority, then of course they would seek to convert to an exclusive union. So it's not that they like the system, but they think it's a pathway. But in addition to that, some academics, at least, who are sympathetic to unions, see that they're in certain ways it's advantageous to have a union like that, where only the only people who are members of the union are supportive of the union. I was just reading in the plane on the way over here an article by Catherine Fisk of the University of California Law School, who is very, you know, close with the unions, and she was acknowledging a number of ways in which members-only unions, you know, by her assessment, would be better than the kind of unions that we have now. So it's not the case, despite what you hear, that this is just impossible or unfeasible. In fact, there are other countries where you essentially have unions that operate like that. It's just a question of how you get there. And that's going to be a long path, because, as you know, I'm going to finish up and take questions. I mean, we had 18 states that had right-to-work laws by the 1955, I think, and we have 23 today, so it was a very rapid movement in the starting a little before the Taft-Hartley Act, because, I don't know if I've said this, but right-to-work laws were permissible before the Taft-Hartley Act. It wasn't explicit in the law, but the Supreme Court did rule in Algoma Plywood, which is after the Taft-Hartley Act. The ruling was after the Taft-Hartley Act, but the case preceded it. The Supreme Court said restrictions on compulsory unionism. In this case, it wasn't a flat-out ban on compulsory membership. It was just a ban on it in certain circumstances that went beyond what the National Labor Relations Act prohibited. But the same principle applies to right-to-work laws. So right-to-work laws were permissible under the previous law. But since the mid-1950s, it's been a slow battle. I mean, we have had passed 5 right-to-work laws in the last, since 1955, I guess it's nearly 60 years, right? So we've passed 6, because 6-7, because Indiana's first law was repealed, and then Louisiana's was repealed, and they passed it again, too. So it's still a slow go. We expect to continue to make progress, and we can put it a better light in it, you know, and make it better in a way, because the progress is not just enactment of state right to work laws. It's a share of the American workforce that's covered by right to work laws, and for a number of reasons, not just because right to work laws are doing better economically, but for a number of reasons, there's a lot of movement of people to right to work states. So despite the fact that prior to Indiana, which hasn't really had an impact yet, there was only one right-to-work law passed after 1990, Oklahoma's in 2001. From 1990 to 2010, the share of employees living in states covered by right-to-work laws, share of private sector employees, went up from 33.8% to 39.4%. And that wasn't mostly because of Oklahoma. That was only a small part of it because of that. Mostly it was because of net domestic migration to right-to-work states. And with Indiana, we move up to nearly 42%. So I've been working at the Right-to-Work Committee since 1990, maybe by the time I retire, we'll be the majority. But it takes a long time I don't know how many of you were involved, but the Right to Work campaign became very visible in Indiana just in the last year or so, but it was actually was a pretty intense campaign from 2003 on in the mail and with their membership. And I was involved in some of the writing and stuff for it, so I happen to know that what I was doing back. So it always astonishes me when the newspaper reporting on this makes it sound like this is something that came out of the blue in the beginning of 2011. We know better than that. It takes a long time, and it takes multiple recorded votes. And we had multiple recorded votes. I don't even know if you were following them, but in Indiana in 2006, 2008, the Right to Work came up in the State House of Representatives and lost in the range of 65 to 31 both times or something like that. You might have actually gotten 35 votes. I don't know, but no more than 35 votes in those two votes. So it's very common to lose by what's – and that was in a GOP-controlled House, too. With a smaller majority than nowadays, but still GOP-controlled. So it was a lot of Republicans as well as Democrats who were voting against that legislation. It takes time to, educate and mobilize the public over it, and then ultimately to get the politicians with you, too. Anyway, I've gone on. And are there any questions?